Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. I'm Tim Wyatt. This week, we have the second half of our conversation we began last week with Dawn McAvoy from the campaign group Both Lives, discussing the recent decriminalisation of abortion by the British Parliament. Last week, we recapped the history of abortion law in the UK, starting with the 1861 Victorian-era Offences Against the Person Act, which criminalised aborting your unborn child, through to growing concerns in the middle of the 20th century about backstreet abortions. Then, the 1967 Abortion Act effectively created exemptions from the 1861 Act if two doctors agreed a mother's physical or mental health would be at greater risk if the pregnancy was continued. An act of compassion intended to protect desperate women from backstreet abortions, which unintentionally ushered in a regime of de facto abortion on demand up to first 28 weeks, later reduced to 24 weeks in 1990. But then, a plot twist. In 2019, Northern Ireland, which had always been exempted from the 1967 Abortion Act due to the deep social conservatism of its own population, suddenly had abortion imposed on them by MPs in London, while the local elected assembly in Belfast was not functioning. And the Northern Irish abortion regime was not the equivalent of England's, but actually a much more sweeping decriminalisation, paving the way for activists to repeat the trick in England earlier this month. But first, never let a good crisis go to waste. How did abortion activists use the unforeseen emergency of the COVID pandemic to accelerate their plans?
We will come back to the actual debate, but I think it's important to talk about what happened in the pandemic, because in retrospect, of course, nobody saw this coming. This was a complete event from left field. But again, abortion activists saw this as...
Never let a good crisis go to waste.
Exactly.
Has
to be
an
cynical,
amazing
but that is
it is.
No, I was just
I'm afraid
thinking
it
the
is.
Same.
It absolutely is. Here is a golden opportunity because for decades, I know in discussion with abortion activists and debates and so on, that their goal has always been to get the pesky medics out of the debate and out of abortion. Because the idea is that abortion is a simple human right, every woman's right to abortion. We don't need these wretched doctors with their paternalism and their wretched consciences and their professional codes of practice and their legal regulation and so on. We don't need any of that. How do we demedicalize abortion? Because the Abortion Act insists that, to begin with, abortions can only be procured with two doctors giving signatures, agreeing in good faith that this, you know, these grounds, and then it should be done in a regulated, licensed premises, only allowed under very strict licensing conditions. And so because of the pandemic, now is the opportunity to say, well, of course we can't expect women to, it would be terribly dangerous for them to come to the clinic. And so instead, we have the so-called pills by post.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly correct. You know, the ultimate goal is to decriminalize and demedicalize. And I would then say, adding on to that, dehumanize the unborn. So there are no restrictions or limitations. So the introduction of pills by post during the COVID pandemic that was introduced on a temporary basis and then subsequently made permanent, I would say that's the most significant difference now between England and Wales and what has just happened based on last week and Northern Ireland, because we don't have pills by post in Northern Ireland. So even if we could all agree, and I don't, for anybody who's listening, that abortion shouldn't be retained within the criminal law, even if we could agree to take the law off the table, we can talk about the practice of abortion that is most safe for both lives. And introducing pills by post is what has opened up the door to some of the horrendous stories we've seen about late-term abortions, babies being born alive and or dead, women being traumatized because they weren't expecting to see what they saw, family members, paramedics even being involved in that, and of course, abusive partners being able to acquire pills and force an unwitting partner to take them, causing forced abortions. None of that, or very little of that, could have happened without a pills by post system.
And we should just clarify for people who aren't familiar with this. So they're in up to the first trimester, is that right? About 12 weeks or so. Abortions have been for many years. You take a series of pills and that induces an abortion.
It's 10 weeks and 6 days is the limit.
And later than that, it is still legal up to 24 weeks, but you need to have a more involved medical surgical procedure.
That's not quite right. So abortions can be done either by surgical or medical reasons, and either can be done at any stage in gestation. So, for instance, it's possible, and it used to be done, in fact, the majority of abortions, even very young, very small, you know, very young fetuses, were done surgically. The woman was given a general anaesthetic and a surgical procedure was performed. Incidentally, I'm just aware that we're talking in this very matter-of-fact way, and I just want to acknowledge, we all understand that this is a deeply painful topic, and there may well be people listening who have been personally affected, and please forgive us if it's not, we're not forgetting what a exceptionally painful thing this is. But so a medical termination can also be done at any stage, but if you do it at under 10 weeks, the risks of medical risks of something going wrong, in particular something like bleeding or some other medical complication, is relatively small. As you go beyond 10 weeks, the risks increase, the risks of hemorrhage, the risks of infection, the risks of retained products of conception, and so on. And therefore, it's not the law, but the advice, the regulation is that medical abortions at home without medical supervision should only be done up to 10 weeks. Mm-hmm. But of course, what all the doctors knew, but which very few of the lay people knew, was that dating pregnancy is actually very difficult. And this to me is such an important point, you know, because people blithely say, oh, of course, if it's 8 weeks, or but it might be 12 weeks. And nobody knows. The idea that women are able to give a precise date when their last medical period was, and then calculate accurately what the maturity of the fetus is, it just isn't true. And although you can get a very rough guide as to the gestation age, it's frequently wildly wrong for both ways. Mm. Again, I don't want to go into the gruesome medical details too much, but it's perfectly possible for women to get the gestation age of their baby completely wrong. And therefore, the only reliable way to do it is with an ultrasound scan. And what used to happen, because the pregnant woman had to go to a clinic, the first thing to do is a so-called dating ultrasound scan, which then gives you really very accurately, or at least within a few days, the gestational age of the fetus. But if you don't have an ultrasound scan, and of course you can't have an ultrasound scan if you're at home, then your ability to know the gestational age is completely has gone. Yeah.
And so broadly speaking, pre-COVID, a woman would go to an abortion clinic, then date the scan on the scan, and if the fetus is deemed to be under the 11-week threshold, she would be given a series of pills and instructions, and she could go home and take them at her leisure.
She had to take the first one.
Sorry, the first
under
one
under supervision.
Under supervision, and the second one you would take home later. Correct. And what was changed was that the so-called telemedicine was that you would have your initial consultation on Zoom or on some video call platform instead. There would be no dating ultrasound, and the doctor would ask you some questions about when was your last period and how far along do you think you are, and would make an assessment, and then post out both pills to you to be taken at home,
Correction, it's not a doctor.
Sorry, not a doctor.
It's not even necessarily a video call. It could be a phone call.
Call.
So
there you
don't
go.
See the person.
You might just be an audio call. So you're completely unaware of the circumstances of the mother, who else is in the room listening along, what kind of pressure might be being put on. And this was framed in COVID as like an obvious temporary kind of, you know, we're in lockdown, we're supposed to be staying at home, it's not safe to go to clinics. And utterly inevitably, in 2022, in England and Wales, it was made permanent because it's a simple, everyday, non-controversial change to the laws. But what I know happened is that suddenly what hadn't happened for decades was that women were having abortions at home of children, of fetuses that were significantly past the 24-week cutoff, causing a whole heap of medical, social, and ultimately legal problems.
Even if they're not beyond the time limit that is recognised as best practice of sort of 10 weeks, 6 days, the abortion notification system didn't even keep up with the introduction of pills by post. So then there was a skewing of the data as to complications from medical abortions, and recent freedom of information requests, and the detail acquired from the hospital episode statistics has shown that I think it was 10,000 women, approximately 10,000 women a year, they're now saying are suffering a degree of complication from the medical abortion that has required them to go to hospital after taking this pill and completing their abortion at home.
So one of the interesting ways is that abortion is viewed within the health service as an completely separate activity compared to all other medical procedures. So for instance, the woman, even though the NHS will pay, the woman does not have to inform any other doctor that she's having an abortion. She doesn't have to inform the GP. The GP is not informed unless she gives her consent. The hospitals are not informed, even if she's under care from hospitals. Nobody, it is entirely confidential that the abortion providers will provide this. So that means, therefore, that if a woman subsequently has complications, she may well go to A&E, to the accident emergency department. She doesn't have to say. So we don't even know whether some women will go with so-called, you know, irregular bleeding or infection or something like that. And it won't even be recorded in the history. Even if it is recorded in the history, there's no way of linking the NHS, which is, again, it's just strange that if it was any other medical procedure, the idea that you'd had a medical procedure and that the NHS doesn't record that or ensure that the GP is informed and so on. It's put in this very separate,
it's siloed off category.
It's a silo, yeah.
And that's just the physical consequences. You know, I had a recent conversation with a GP who was asking questions around the notification of the family doctor in this context, but was also talking about the mental health implications. And I wasn't given any personal confidential details, but from the perspective of this GP, you know, receiving information from patients where they're reflecting on the harm from an abortion that was performed years previously, potentially, but there's no link in the medical records. So though the patient is saying, I know when this happened, the GP was saying there's neither evidence to support or deny that fact. So how we record abortions, the impact physically and mentally of abortion on a woman all of that could be much better recorded and analysed if we truly want to respond in a way that's evidence-based and in line with best care for women.
And this is very important because it means that really all scientific research into the consequences of abortion, especially in the UK, is deeply flawed.
Yeah.
For very obvious scientific reasons. We simply don't know.
And that then feeds into the ability of Parliament to listen to something and respond in a way, because it's just normal. It's the most common gynecological procedure. It's 1 in 3 women. It's been perceived and accepted as a social and health good. So we just pass it. But there are so many gaps in information and knowledge that it's brought us to this point where, yes, we have now effectively legalized self-induced abortions throughout pregnancy at any stage up to birth outside of any medical oversight or care.
So just to finish the story, so I think most of what had happened, what we talked about, pills by post, the 2019 decriminalisation in Northern Ireland, to be fair, that I think that passed most ordinary people by who aren't interested in abortion policy. But where it started hitting the headlines was from about 2023, so a year or two into the permanent pills by post telemedicine regime, there was a handful of criminal prosecutions. So women who were being taken to the courts and prosecuted and in a handful of cases sent to prison because they had aborted children using the pills by post scheme well into the third trimester, so beyond the legal 24-week limit. The most infamous case was a woman who misled BPAS, the abortion provider, by saying that she was only a few weeks along when she was actually 28 weeks pregnant at the time.
33 weeks potentially, yes, when she gave birth to her baby daughter Lily, yes.
And this kind of, I think, jolted and shocked a lot of commentators who were thought, well, hang on, I thought we've had legal abortion for donkey's years. Why on earth are women being prosecuted for this? And that, I think, has basically laid the groundwork for the decriminalisation, which is the arguments used by the pro-abortion lobby groups, is that this archaic Victorian 1861 act is being used to hound desperate, scared women who made a mistake or were in horrible circumstances. Who can tolerate sending women to prison for something as fundamental of their right as choosing to end a pregnancy? The solution, therefore, must be to completely decriminalise, and that's effectively what the law does. It disapplies the 1861 Act to women. It is the case that if you are an abortion provider, regulated, a medical professional, you're not allowed to perform an abortion beyond 24 weeks, but there can be no criminal sanctions whatsoever for a woman who is found to have carried out an abortion at home with pills.
I'm sorry, this is all, again, very grisly medical details, but, you know, we have to face the reality. So if we take an example of this tragic story of a woman who produces, you know, who delivers alone, unsupported, without any kind of nursing, midwifery, medical help at all, and who delivers a baby at 33 weeks, say, or whatever, that baby, if that baby is born dead, with no signs of life, then the woman cannot be prosecuted, whatever happened to it results. But if that baby shows signs of life, that baby is now alive and is protected by this panoply of legal rights and protections. Mm. This is a baby who is a citizen of the United Kingdom and who is protected by homicide laws and so on. If this baby cries, and most babies born at 33 weeks will cry and will be alive and wriggling and go pink and breathe and so on. In fact, virtually all of them will do that. So now what happens? If the mother in desperation, you know, does something like puts a hand over the baby's mouth and the baby dies, technically, legally, that mother still, in the law as it is now, is guilty of homicide. In fact, there is a special legal statute of infanticide, but it's still a serious criminal offence. So, you know, what are the implications? What are we doing to the basis of law? Imagine the paramedics who come along to discover this scene, or the police. You know, should the police be called? Is this how do they decide? Is this insensitive? How do we as a society? Because in general, we're horrified by the idea of people killing babies. You know, whenever there's a case of a baby abandonment, you know, that sometimes hits the news, the amount of nationwide concern expressed about a baby left alive.
And I think that's exactly what caught so many legislators last week. You know, those who were speaking out against it, you know, thankfully were raising that as a point, you know, but this could potentially be viable babies who are being born. And what happens to them, and of course to the mother, as you said. Do you know? I mean, I can't imagine having had three labours. I can't imagine doing that on my own, intentionally. Do you know? Willing that the baby is aborted, and then what do you do if baby either is born alive or indeed dead? And actually, there were two abortion amendments that were tabled last week. The one that was passed, which was Tonya Antoniazzi's, that removed women from the criminal law, was probably even the least extreme of the two. And the second amendment, which was tabled by Stella Creasy, wanted to fully decriminalise, but as has been done in Northern Ireland, but she also had added the decriminalisation of Section 60 of the Offences Against the Person Act. Now, that wasn't decriminalised for Northern Ireland, but that specific section speaks exactly to what you've just been raising, John. Section 60 is referred to as the concealment of birth, but it's the concealment of birth, a death, and that's a death before, during or after birth, and a body. So in effect, Stella Creasy was saying that it shouldn't be a crime to then dispose secretly of a baby's body that has been born. Now, what struck me listening to some of the abortion providers who were commenting on Tonya Antoniazzi's amendment that they were all in support of, one spokesperson said they were supporting Tonya's amendment, not Stella's, but not based on the proposals within that second amendment, more based on the timing and the process of that. So it was definitely, what I heard was an inference that actually what was decriminalized last week is stage one, and I have no doubt that abortion providers and others, activists, will be looking to go much further in decriminalization. And that speaks back to, I think, what you said, Tim, about the to and fro and taking advantage of a point in time to introduce your agenda. And then, God willing, none of us on this call want to see any woman permanently harmed or indeed die by inducing her own abortion. But I have no doubt that given the right circumstances, abortion activists will then say, well, it's not safe for women to do it outside of a medical framework, so we now need to decriminalise up to birth within the medical framework, and then it will be done safely.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And then, without ever really having any public debate or consent, you have created the one of the world's most liberal permissive abortion regimes, in which women can, up to 40 weeks, end the life of their unborn child for any reason by official taxpayer-provided healthcare. And you just think, actually, if you polled that, if you asked the British public, you know, put aside the Christians and the pro-life activists, if you just ask the British public, do you want that? Is there any meaningful demand beyond the kind of BPAS Mary Stopes extremists who actually want a fully decriminalized legal to birth for any reason you can end your pregnancy?
ComRes did polling, I think in 2017, it was with a couple of thousand British citizens, and it was 1% of the public polled supported abortion up to birth. So there is not the demand amongst the public. But that's where these tagged on amendments that are rushed through without scrutiny are so effective in achieving an agenda that you know the public doesn't support.
So to kind of to draw that policy legal question to a close, we should emphasise that the amendment has been passed by the House of Commons, but it now has to go through the House of Lords. And it's kind of open question as to how the peers will respond. There is a long tradition that the House of Lords kind of defers to the House of Commons in most instances because they're the democratically elected chamber. But that convention doesn't really apply in this case because none of the parties kind of stood on the manifesto at their last election to decriminalize abortion to term. So there is some speculation that maybe the House of Lords will try and mobilize against this or at the very least amend it in certain ways. So we'll have to watch closely to see how that happens. But if it does pass in through the House of Lords in the form it is at now, what it effectively means that for a woman who is prepared to either lie or mislead about how far along they are, they could, you know, on a phone call with an abortion provider, get pills by post all the way up to 40 weeks. Or if a woman is being pressured and forced to lie or mislead about how far along they are. That's the other thing. This is often framed as, you know, women doing this by themselves, but actually a real concern from a lot of people is this opens the door to abortions being effectively forced upon mothers by coercive, abusive partners, where the in-person visit and the legal frame before acted as a kind of defense against that.
Yes, I would like to just mention briefly the role of the Royal College of Obstetrics and Gynecology in this process, because it's very striking that all the way along the line, the RCOG, which is the premier professional organization for professional gynecologists, obstetricians, has actually been supportive of the process and supportive of decriminalization, supportive of pills by post. And I, as a member of, a fellow of two other colleges, I'm a fellow, as it happens, you know, I'm a fellow of the Royal College of Physicians, I'm a fellow of the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health. And I know that the Royal Colleges take very seriously this view that we are the gold standard. If anybody has any question about paediatrics,
come to us.
Then we are the gold standard of the physicians. If we've got anything about medicine and about drugs and pharmaceuticals and all that stuff, we, the Royal College of Physicians, are the gold standard. We preserve our independence and our integrity, absolutely. And yet, looking across to the RCOG, I am, frankly, deeply concerned, if not appalled, that highly skilled and well-informed obstetricians and gynecologists who know absolutely everything that we've said about dating scans, about the risks of medical abortions, about the risks of unsupervised birth, about the risks of homicide, of a baby born alive, have not pointed this out in public. But have simply, it appears, supported the abortion activists. And if you look at who are the members of the governing body of the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, it turns out that many of them are actually abortion providers themselves. They are advisors to the main abortion industry. They are performing abortions as private practice. And therefore, there is the most astonishing conflict of interest. it's almost as though for the Royal College of Physicians, we had the pharmaceutical industry, advising and promoting policy, that informing and influencing and deciding RCP policy, which would be regarded as completely outrageous and a massive conflict of interest. But because abortion is seen again as an utterly separate entity, normal standards about conflicts of interest, normal standards about professional accuracy, about the objectivity, the need to ensure that everyone understands, all of that is lost because in the end, this is a feminist issue. And I think partly it's a conflict of interest, but I think the other thing is that senior doctors are desperately concerned not to be seen as paternalistic, not to be seen as, oh, well, of course, we know best. And therefore, in this issue, I think it's almost like, well, if this is what the women want, then we must allow them. This is, you know, we can't be seen as patriarchal, patronizing, and paternalistic.
I mean, there's a one particular, not to name names, but I am going to name one name, who just, yeah, always kind of grinds my gears. A doctor called Jonathan Lord, who is often quoted in news articles about abortion because he is the co-chair of the RCOG's abortion task force and kind of has a, you know, a kind of national role in talking about abortion policy. And he's often quoted as, you know, Dr. Jonathan Lord, this consultant gynecologist, you know, decades of experience. And yet then you read another story and he's quoted as Dr. Jonathan Lord, medical director of Mary Stopes UK, the UK's leading abortion provider. So he's literally employed by an abortion, one of the largest abortion providers. And yet he's often quoted as an entirely neutral, impartial gynecologist as offering us his specialist medical voice. And that is just intensely frustrating that there isn't more attention drawn to the fact that these conflicts of interest, the RCOG is supposed to be, as you say, the gold standard of professional, independent, impartial, expert voice. And yet you could argue it's been kind of captured by the abortion industry and nods along, even though they know more than I ever will what the risks are for women, that women will die as a result of this amendment if it's passed. There will be, I can guarantee you, tragically, a small number of women will die having taken abortion pills at home for very late term abortions, and there is a complication and there isn't a midwife or a doctor around or get there in time, women will die because of this. And the very medical college whose job it is to protect pregnant women's health are just nodding it through with it's just astonishing dereliction of duty.
It is staggering. And again, as a woman who has been pregnant and given birth, you know, I wanted my doctors and nurses and midwives, you know, there's no way on earth I would have ever wanted to sort of do that whole journey and birth on my own. And you want to be able to trust the people who are looking after you. And I think all of this actually raises the issue of trust, you know, about the information we're being given, the advice we're being given, and the care that we're being offered, which is really dangerous for so many people. And even back to the polling, you know, the majority of women and men polled in that ComRes survey said in the context of pregnancy crisis and abortion, potential abortion counselling, they wanted all of that to be independent of the abortion providers. And that's another conflict of interest. So we have the RCOG and the abortion providers and the supposedly neutral, non-directive counselling all linked and connected.
So Tim, you know, back to you. Why is no investigative journalist who, you know, when you think of all the other things that the investigative journalists do in pointing out conflicts of interest and dark things that people are wanting to keep quiet, you know, why will no investigative journalist touch it with a barge pole?
Well, we all know the answer, right? It's because it's a taboo subject. It's a taboo subject. Who, you know, if you're an investigative journalist and you want to dig into the background of Dr. Jonathan Lord or any other number of gynecologists who have gotten deeply enmeshed in the abortion industry while retaining their privileged position in shaping RCOG policy, who is going to publish that? You know, where are you going to take that? The only people who are interested in that story are kind of relatively fringe, kind of pro-life or kind of Christian religious outlets. You know, you can't see a major national newspaper wanting to go there, primarily because the people who work for the newspapers believe, rightly or wrongly, that this is a quote-unquote settled issue. You know, you don't go digging when you're not necessarily sure you want to find out what the answers are. Do we want to undermine confidence in what is a, quote, settled issue? Do we want to expose the contradictions that shoot through the way this country talks and acts around abortion? No, of course we don't. It's too uncomfortable, so we look the other way and focus our efforts elsewhere.
But doesn't that feel like a dereliction of duty for investigative journalism? Yes, I mean, 100%. In terms of what investigative journalists yes. claim they're about... Yeah, isn't absolutely. It precisely the settled issues which nobody don't go there because you might find something that you're going to find very unsettling?
Yeah, absolutely.
And
there are countless examples throughout history of journalism where a maverick reporter has challenged the orthodoxy or questioned the thing. And with hindsight, we're all like, what a brilliant, brave, trailblazing pioneer they were. Aren't we so grateful for their willingness to not listen to the editors and shut them down? But in the moment that, you know, yeah. I think the journalism as industry, I say this with no pleasure, but is just as captured by the kind of groupthink and the willful self-delusion that I think the wider British society is immersed in. And this goes back to your point at the very beginning, Dawn, law shapes culture. Why does England have the culture of abortion that it has? In one part, not entirely, but one part, it's because of the 67 Act. And the way that has everyone who's an adult today has been grown up in a culture immersed in that act and its kind of unforeseen downstream consequences. And that has made abortion very, very difficult to see and think clearly on.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there's no going back to that settled point or that perception of this is a settled issue and we'll all just quietly concede to the status quo. What happened for Northern Ireland and what happened last week off the back of Northern Ireland, I think shows that there's no going back. And I actually think eyes have been opened and ears are now listening, maybe that weren't before. I'm hoping, you know, and we all love Jesus. You know, we haven't actually talked about faith in the context of this. I'm praying for a quiet revolution, you know, within the medical professions, within journalism, within any professional bodies that can affect change, and amongst the public and indeed in the church, you know, because regardless of what Westminster does or doesn't do, God is sovereign and he's in control. We each have a role to play amongst our families and friendship groups. We can have the conversation, we can ask the questions. And I think the church has ultimately the better story. You know, we believe in the sanctity of life, in human dignity from conception to natural death. Jesus was formed in the womb of his mother. He was conceived at that point. There's a better story that the church can offer that values women in pregnancy and their unborn life, the unborn children, pre and post birth. So this isn't an abdication of the church, and I would challenge the church to do a lot more, you know, to respond with compassion and to serve women and children and support the medics and healthcare professionals in their churches, you know, who are working and operating, and journalists who are working in this context where culture does need challenged, and we can all have a part to play in serving for the sake of both lives.
And can I ask you, Dawn, if you were going to change one thing in terms of public policy to support pregnant, unsupported, single women who find themselves, what would it be? What area would you think would make the most difference to single, unsupported women at risk of being coerced by boyfriends or family or whatever?
I think at a policy level, we immediately reinstate in-person consultations. And at that point, as the NHS, which is the taxpayer-funded health and social care system, we connect all of the social and healthcare supports. So at this point, that's another example of how it's siloed. Abortion is seen as a healthcare procedure, and all of the social care supports, albeit they could be improved, sit to the side. So at the point of a pregnancy crisis, you can just get a phone consultation, access pills by post, and there is nobody helping you perceive alternative pathways. So I think bring it all together under health and social care as a policy decision and an in-person consultation. And that doesn't even then speak to the other social structures that parachurch and third sector providers can put in place as well.
Because, I mean, I would endorse everything Dawn has said. I think, you know, let's not underestimate the power of prayer, and absolutely, you know, churches need to roll their sleeves up and you know, get a bit braver, really, to step into this and not just shy away from abortion because it is controversial, because it is scary, because you're afraid of being tarred as extremists. But I think as well, I'm often struck by that phrase, it's often used, I think, more in the States here, is that the goal is not just to make abortion illegal, but to make abortion unthinkable. And you do that by creating such a thick, loving, compassionate wraparound culture of care for women who are considering abortion that they of their own volition decide that there is a better way. And we've talked before on this podcast about things like crisis pregnancy centers, which offer some of that care, but it goes bigger than that. It's about, you know, how open are churches to befriending single mothers, providing them with clothes and baby equipment if they need it. If they're worried about the finances, you know, how can we support women to say, look, we'll make it possible for you to raise your child well, even if you don't have a job right now. It's those kind of things where I'd love to see the church step up and say, yes, we want to tackle the legal framework. Yes, we have a lot to say about the very dark path our parliament is leading this country down in terms of policy. But also we want to go to the other end and look at the demand for abortion. And what we'd really love to do is to start cutting that demand from abortion. And then so much of that is possible without ever having to change a single law in Westminster.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, for those who are listening who are currently facing a potential pregnancy crisis, or indeed might in the near future, either themselves or in their family or friendship circle, I would really encourage them to look outside of the abortion providers and turn to pregnancy crisis centres and look for where there is practical, emotional and spiritual support that would enable both lives to live and thrive together. And in so many cases, the women that we've spoken to who felt driven to abortion would have rather not if they had had the support of the friends and family around them. We often say, you know, government has a role to play, the third sector has a role to play, but for so many women, they'd actually just need their friends and family to congratulate them and to help them do life with their baby.
Well, that seems like an appropriate place to draw our conversation to a close. Thank you so much for listening. I'm aware it's quite a sensitive, painful topic for many people who have been impacted by the issue of abortion in different ways. So apologies if we have, in our enthusiasm to unpack many of the very many complicated parts of this, not been kind of cognizant of that. Thank you so much to Dawn for sharing your expertise and your experiences and helping us kind of tell the story well of where we got to where we are. If people want to find out more about Both Lives, what's the best place to go for that?
bothlives.co.uk. They can find us on social media as well, Instagram, Facebook and X.
Brilliant. And if you'd like to get in touch with us about anything we've talked about today, we're really interested to hear your thoughts, particularly listeners who are maybe pregnant themselves or have had abortions in the past or have a particular perspective on this. We'd love to hear what you think. And also, if you have any suggestions for other topics we could talk about on the podcast, we're always keen to hear that. You can email us molad@premier.org.uk. And you can also find lots of resources and interesting things to stimulate your thinking on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. There's a whole drop-down section in depth about abortion and its related kind of ethical dilemmas and issues and how, the Bible and Christianity can speak into that. And if you'd like to find some of my journalism, you can find that on my website, tswyatt.com. Otherwise, we will speak to you again next week. Until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.